Raymond Foy is an author, editor, small press publisher, and art curator based in New York. Foy studied at the Art Institute of Chicago and San Francisco Art Institute. He began working as a freelance editor at City Light Books and New Directions. From 80 to 85, he worked as editor at Peterborough Press, where he oversaw limited edition and book publishing projects with artists such as David Hockney, Roy Lichtenstein, Robert Motherwell, Howard Hodgkins, Jasper Johns, and Francesco Clemente. In 85, he traveled to India with Clemente, where they founded the publishing firm Hahnemann Books, bringing out 50 books over the next 10 years, including original titles by Patti Smith, Cookie Mueller, Eileen Miles, Candy Darling, and Rene Ricard, and John Wiener's was the first one. It was a superficial estimation. From 90 to 95, he was the director of exhibitions and publications at Gagosian Gallery, New York, where he worked on exhibitions and catalogs with Richard Serra, Ed Ruscha, Mark DeSavero, Philip Taff, and Damien Hirst. Since 95, Foy has worked independently on writing, editing, publishing, and curating projects. His exhibitions featuring the visual artwork of underground filmmaker and ethnomusicologist Harry Smith was named by the New York Times as one of the 10 best exhibitions of 2002. And I think it was with Fred Tomaselli and with Philip Taff. And the catalog that came from that was titled Heavenly Earth, or the
title
from Garrett.
Heavenly Tree
Grows Downward. And but he kindly gave us both a copy of it, which I treasure, that book. Foy is also the executor of the estates of poet Jamie Schuyler, John Wieners, and Ray Ricard, and is presently editing the later works of Gregory Corso and a comprehensive edition of the writings of Ray Ricard. And this is from Allen Ginsberg, from a picture of Raymond that he had taken in his archive, and here is his intro of Raymond. Raymond Foy, who age 8 was Kerouac's newspaper delivery boy in Lowell, Mass., later working for City Lights, edited Bob Kaufman's books, also for New Directions, and John Wiener selected poems for Black Sparrow. Then senior editor at Hahnemann Books, arranged my collaborations with Francesco Clemente, and cataloged my photo negatives, 47 to 85, and curated my first show. And there's an article, I think, in the Allen Ginsberg Project, or interview with Raymond about his involvement with Allen Ginsberg's photos that you should really read. They're really great stuff. So the last part is mine. Here's my introduction. Raymond dignifies the poets and artists he admires by honoring their work with his brilliant curation. He is humble, down-to-earth, but also intense and a bit mysterious. Once when we were walking to oral history on Wieners, he said, "Stories are fine, but we must make sure we honor John's work." His meticulous care of John and his work shows in the Black Sparrow collected. It's a seminal collection, but what really struck me was his inclusion of interviews with John, and that just hit me recently in the appendix that... the work is brilliant, but the interviews really captured the unique person John was. And I continue to go back to those interviews with Charlie Shively and Van Hollenberg and include those in a poetry collection. I think it's brilliant, and it shows that Raymond honors the work and the man. And when he came up to Boston, Raymond may have given John money, but the one thing I remember him giving John was glasses. John always appreciated the glasses that Raymond gave him, and I always remember that. Raymond brought Herbert Hunky to Lowell and cared for him in his final days in the Chelsea, toured with Patti Smith, and arranged Wiener's legendary readings at the Warhol Museum and at the Guggenheim, both celebrating Francesco Clemente's work. Raymond also published Rene Ricard's God with Revolver, and Rene was art critic, the holy terror of New York art scene, but he was also a poet whose work was influenced and echoes Wiener's work. Both Massachusetts-born, Ricard's visits to Wiener's when he worked at Jordan Marsh inspired Rene to move to New York. And if you see him reading online some of the later work, he really develops a style very similar to Wiener's. And I think when he died, when Wiener's died, he did a painting that said, "My Cosmic Mother Has Died," I think is what it said. So without any further ado, please join me in welcoming Raymond Foy.
So this is just for the recording. It's not amplification, right? Okay, so if you can't hear me, just let me know and I'll try to speak up. Thank you for the introductions. Kerouac was on my paper route, The Lowell Sun, daily and Sunday, on Sanders Avenue in Lowell. I had no idea that he was Jack Kerouac, but I do remember him because he was home during the daytime, and there were no men at home in the daytime in that neighborhood back then, and I used to always think, what is this guy doing at home in the daytime? How come he's not out working? Because he was Jack Kerouac. And... But then he, and so he moved away from Lowell. He went down to St. Petersburg. Was it St. Petersburg? Yeah.
Yes.
With his mother and Stella. And then he died, and I was opening the papers one day, and there was this picture on the front page of the Lowell Sun. And I was like, oh, yeah, that's that guy. So when I went home, I mentioned this to my parents, and they're like, oh, yeah, Jack Kerouac. My father played football with him on Lowell High School. My mother's desk at the Lowell Sun, she was the secretary to the editor, Charlie Sampas. He was the editor of the paper. She was his secretary. And Jack eventually married his sister, Stella. And Jack's desk was directly across from my mother's desk. He was a sports writer at the time. This was, he'd come back from Columbia, but he'd yet to really go out on the road. And he was writing The Town and the City, which, of course, is Lowell and New York, and the main character in that, Sabby Sabaticus, was was Sammy Sampas, Charlie's younger brother. And they just knew him as somebody who never said a word. He'd never, not a peep out of him, ever. They'd go to football games, and the entire way on the bus there and back, he wouldn't say one word. So when they saw Life magazine, King of the Beats, you know, they were like, no, 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 you've got the wrong guy here. So that was the Jack Kerouac connection. And then his funeral was in Lowell, and it was on TV, the local news station, and it was a big deal. And Allen Ginsberg came, Gregory Corso, John Cullen Holmes, Robert Creeley. And I skipped school and rode my bike down to the church, Saint Jean d'Arc, and I got there in time to see them all coming out in the coffin. And I'd known at that point, I knew Alan and his work because he was on daytime TV all the time. He was on Merv Griffin. He was on David Frost. Dick Cavett was maybe a year or two. No, Dick Cavett was around that time too. And, you know, we live in such conservative times now. And in the 60s, one of the things that happened was the cat got out of the bag in terms of the counterculture. And they're going to make damn sure that doesn't happen again. And that's one reason why small press publishing and, you know, punk rock and all these things that we do are really important. You know, I mean, these are difficult times, but I very much believe in these kinds of endeavors. So that was there was the funeral. And then in 1973, Jay McHale at Salem State College did a Kerouac symposium. And the high school honors English class was allowed to go because it was considered a little bit risque. This was April of 73. But because the English teacher, Rita Sullivan, knew that I was reading Kerouac and Ginsberg, she let me go with them. And so that's when I kind of met all these people. Peggy Bitterman was with them. She's the reason I moved into the Chelsea. She's somebody who, in Patti Smith's Just Kids book, she talks about, and I'm really glad because otherwise you wouldn't really know. There are so many people who were so great and important in this whole movement, especially the women, and you just will never know about them. It's like the book A Blue Hand about Hope Savage. You know, that's a really tremendous book, and you just would never know anything about Hope Savage otherwise. Who Renee said was the Rambo of the Beats and the person who inspired him to write poetry. So when I was there, I hooked up with these guys and I arranged to meet them in Cambridge at the weekend. This was like a Thursday when we went down. Gregory read Elegiac Feelings American, his poem to Kerouac, which I think is his greatest poem. And it was just unbelievable. So I hooked up with them in Cambridge where they had another reading. And I remember the two things they were really doing. They were trying to find John Wieners. And they were looking everywhere. And it was really important that they should find John Wieners. And they couldn't find him. And everybody they asked, well, had seen him, but he had just left or he hasn't been around. They never did get to see John, but I got this sense that here was somebody who was kind of a poet's poet and a kind of a haunted figure and a ghost-like figure and just somebody who was there but not there. And the other thing was Gregory Corso was really intent, because the reading was at Harvard, at getting through to a Sumerian scholar, because he wanted to know what are the first words ever written. And so he finally did meet one of these guys, you know, who was a Sumerian specialist. And he said, well, there's a bit of a disagreement between two things. One is a recipe for beer, which he loved. And the other is a cuneiform tablet of two elders arguing that the youth today don't respect their elders, the old gods aren't being worshipped. Basically, it says things aren't what they used to be. And Gregory said, there, you see, he said to me, if you go back as far as you possibly can, you'll always be getting closer to the truth. So the next time I saw John, sort of chanced on a reading in Inman Square. There was a cafe there that was doing readings, and it was Mother's Day, and he read every poem he'd written about his mother, and it was absolutely stunning. And the poem, and the reading was over in 5 minutes, but he read, you know, like, I don't know, 13 poems, including My Mother Looked Better in Her Coffin Than I Do Today Standing in the Mirror. And I was much too shy in those days to approach him. And so then I kind of moved on. I was in San Francisco and started working for City Lights. I did a Poe anthology for them. I ghost wrote a literary history of San Francisco with Ferlinghetti. And I started, the Beatitude magazine was a popular magazine at the time. And one of the great things about the zine scene was it was definitely do-it-yourself, and there was nothing intimidating about it. You saw, oh, I can do this. So I edited an issue of Beatitude magazine with Neely Cherkovsky. It was sort of a tribute to Bob Kaufman. And I started collecting Bob's poems because I just thought he was so terrific. And he was obviously somebody who couldn't keep the stuff together himself. And there were a lot of people who had saved things on napkins and manuscripts. So I started putting together a collection. I inherited the apartment that he lived in at 28 Harwood Alley, and he left some manuscripts behind. And I very carefully gathered them up, and I saw him on the street one day. And I'm like, here, Bob, you left these behind. He's like, I don't want them. So, and then his hotel burned down. And I went into the hotel, the Dante Hotel, a couple of days after the police and the firemen left and crossed, went under the fire, you know, do not enter lines, and went up to his room because I used to visit him there and knew where it was. And sure enough, there was this famous Moroccan leather binding that Claude Pelliou and Mary Beach talk about on the back cover of Golden Sardine, and it had a whole stack of poems. So, and then I went to the Bancroft Library, and slowly I collected these poems and until I had a book-length volume and went to New Directions, and they said, yeah, we'll do this. So that was kind of how I got started on the whole editorial front. I mean, I was an art student. I was interested in painting, filmmaking. But after I graduated from art school, you know, a painter is somebody who gets up every single day and paints involuntarily. I did not do that. Which meant I was interested in painting, I was interested in art school, the parties were great, you know. But, I found, and I was interested in poetry, but I hate bad poetry and I didn't like anything that I was writing. And eventually I realized I was kind of this person in between poets and painters, and I was somebody who tried to be helpful to people. You know, especially at that age where, like, if you want to be around, you got to, like, bring something to the table. You have to make yourself useful. You have to copy out notebooks or, so I had this sense of kind of duty and service. And that's what Hanuman means. Hanuman is about service. So in San Francisco, one evening, I had a kind of epiphany over John Wiener's. I had a copy of, or my roommate, Neely Cherkovsky, had a copy of Robert Kelly's Controversy of Poets. And I opened it up and I read, The Acts of Youth. Yeah, that's in that. And it completely blew me away. I was just stunned. I could not believe it. And I remember Harold Norris once said to me, when you're young, at a certain point, you hit on a poet, and that is the person who really speaks to you more than anybody else. And I'm fortunate in that I have like four or five of those people. But John suddenly, that's the moment that I got him. And So I moved back to New York shortly thereafter, and on my birthday, a very good friend of mine, Henry Geldzahler, said to me, what do you want for your birthday? And I said, I'd like you to go to Phoenix Bookshop and buy every book they have by John Wieners. So he did that, and that's what he gave me for my birthday. And they were the first five books of John's. They were Hotel Wentley, Ace of Pentacles, Pressed Wafer, Asylum Poems, and Nerves. And I remember him remarking that Robert Wilson, who owned the bookstore, he said, boy, he was a little hoity-toity. He said, I almost wasn't good enough to buy these books, which is Bob Wilson to a T. So, and then I took the books and I went out to Southampton, where I was crashing at this place, and I spent a whole weekend reading him. And it's like that Dylan, you know, song, every one of them words rang true and glowed like burning coals pouring out of every page like it was written in my soul from me to you. It was just that. It was like every poem was like branded into my brain. And then I thought, wow, this guy is the real thing. And I had this image of him from his poetry that he was a kind of John Keats figure. You know, there were this Augustan sort of rhythms, and he was a Boston poet, maybe not quite as conservative as Robert Lowell, but definitely cut from that cloth. He was a sort of a proper Bostonian, and the poetry has a sort of formalism to it, and oftentimes it rhymes. None of those books were particularly radical in any way, and that was another thing I couldn't understand, because I was very much into sort of radicality in language, and here was somebody who was almost retardataire, who was a traditionalist. So I thought, I have to meet this guy. And one Thanksgiving, when I went home to visit my parents in Lowell, on the Friday after Thanksgiving, I took the Boston and Maine Railroad from Lowell to Boston, and I got off at the North Station, and I had John's address from somebody, and I went to see him. I just rang his doorbell, and I rang and I waited, and finally he came downstairs sort of huffing and puffing, and he looked at me, and I said, Mr. Wieners. And he said, are you here to repair the toaster? And I said, no, I'm not. I'm an editor, and I really love your work, and I was hoping I could meet you. He said, you're not here to repair the toaster. And I said, no, I'm not. I was wondering if I could meet you. And he said, can you come back tomorrow? And I said, yes. What time? He said, same time. And then he turned and he walked back up the stairs. So I left, and I remember walking back to the train thinking, like, who's ever heard of a toaster repairman? I mean, especially one who makes house calls. Little did I know it would be only the first of a great many non sequiturs I would hear from John over the years. And I went to see him the next day, and we just had a great time. I mean, he was very shy and very arch and very witty, and he was very there and he was very not there, and he was just mysterious. But more than that, there was a kind of charm, you know, to be in John's. All right, now I have to look at my watch because I'm supposed to have about 40 minutes and I have to not blabber on too much. The thing about John was, when you were in his presence, it was like a charm. You know, you were just in this world that was really magical. And as great as the poems are, I mean, one day in the life of John Wieners was like so much more inherently poetical than any poem. So what I began to do with John was to put together all the stray things that I came across in little magazines. I started visiting people in Boston and working my way backwards through his network. And I quickly found that John was somebody who was respected by everyone. And so he kind of became a calling card, you know, in the poetry world. It's almost like when musicians get together, at a certain point, eventually they get around to stories about Bob Dylan, because everybody respects him so much, and he's so weird, and the stories are so strange, and there's a sort of inexplicable quality where after you leave, you know, like with John, you just think, well, what did he mean by that? And it would really haunt you, and you'd think about it for a long time. So I started visiting John regularly on trips up to Boston and collecting his work, and before too long, I had a lot of material. I was surprised at just how much there was. And this thing about memorability, I never encountered a Wiener's poem a second time that I didn't remember it. And I mean remember the whole thing. And it's not that I have such a great memory. It's just that's the way the writing is. I think memorability is definitely one of the aesthetic qualities of great art. And so he had that. And so I decided that, you know, it was time to do a book because those five books were all out of print. Now, at this point, I'd finally gotten on to Behind the State Capitol, which is the point where John's whole world explodes, and it's an absolutely extraordinary book. It's still out of print. I put a bunch of it in the selected poems. Hopefully, we're going to get, Yale University was interested. Hopefully, we're going to get a 50th anniversary or soon an edition of it with a lot of essays. Because it's, well, okay, this is the book that I had to really grapple with as well, because I was in love with the Belle Lettriste John Wieners. And a lot of people felt Behind the State Capitol was a complete betrayal. I remember Robert Duncan telling me that he thought that John was very ill-served by this book, because it showed what was essentially a, in his view, a disordered mind. And it showed John's, well, this was another issue that I had to come to grips with John on many different levels, which is where was he at mentally? Because he clearly was suffering from some forms of mental illness. And I never, I mean, I wouldn't want to make any kind of amateur diagnosis, but he definitely had been institutionalized many times. He was certainly a victim of the mental health industry in the 60s. I mean, he told me that he was dragged out of his house at 2 a.m. kicking and screaming simply because he liked to stay up all night writing poems. He said, I didn't get inspired until late at night, and so I stayed up all night, and he was living at home with his parents. And his sister said to me, well, you know, my parents, they just didn't know what to do with him. He was getting worse and worse, and they'd heard that this, you know, new procedure, shock treatment could do some good, and they certainly didn't have any ill intention, but he was, you know, taken away in a straitjacket after an episode and given shock treatment, which he told me knocked out all of the French that he had. He spoke French before that. That was his major at Boston College. So the Behind the State Capitol was dealing with those issues, and then what John was still writing, which went into the sort of the ending of this book, this first selected poems, was also work that was very controversial. So, I decided that it was time to bring this work back into print, and I wrote a letter to John Martin, because he's Black Sparrow Press seemed a very sympathetic publishing house, and I made sure Allen Ginsberg was behind the project, Robert Creeley was behind the project. And John Martin right away said, yes, absolutely, he would do it. And I said, well, you know, I need 500 pages. And he said, oh, we can't possibly do that. We can only do 200 pages. And I said, no, we need 400 pages. So we just went into all this horse trading. And then I decided to just drop that issue and to just edit the book that I wanted to edit, not too excessively. And that became this first Black Sparrow book. And since I thought this might be the only book of John's that was going to come out for a long time, that I sort of owed it to John to reprint those first five books, because he edited those, and they're perfect books of poetry. And then I would take a section of uncollected poems and a section from Behind the State Capitol, and then a section of new poems. And that brought us up to 316 pages. And finally, John Martin went along with it when he got the manuscript. And but then one day he called me up all upset, and he's like, what is this letter all about? And I'm like, what letter? Read it to me. And he'd gotten a letter from John Wieners, and it said, Dear Mr. Martin, I would like to inform you that the mistress of the Pope is a very wealthy woman. I would like my new book to be entitled Night Nurse at Massachusetts General Hospital, to consist entirely of new poems and to be less than 100 pages. And I said, oh no, he doesn't know. Never mind. Just ignore that. And then I called John up and I said, John, please don't write any more letters to John Martin. And he was like, okay, Ray. So we sort of got through that period. And when we brought this book out, there were a couple of things I wanted to do from an editorial standpoint. One of them was I wanted to preface every section of the book with a photograph of John, because I wanted people to see what he looked like at these various phases. I always liked how when you got a Dylan album, there was a picture of him on the cover, and it showed you where he was at that point in his life, in the style and the way he looked. And you'd listen to the record, and you'd look at the cover, and you just had a sense of who this person was. And I kind of wanted people to see John. And there was also a story that was told as these pictures progressed, where you see a very haunted person, a very hollowed out person emerge. And of course, drugs had a lot to do with that. I also wanted to include a couple of interviews, because there were two very, very good interviews with John. One of them was straight on, rational, and the other was completely irrational. And I thought those were the two sides of John's mind. And by then, I had begun to catch on to one of the things that sort of put me onto how good his late work was, aside from reading it, and I liked it from the start. I thought it was marvelous. Olson's projective verse, one thought must immediately lead to another, and this he was tracking his thought process very carefully. I thought, well, how he's still using language, you know, how mad can he be if he's still using language? I was familiar with Hölderlin's late poems, with the poems of John Clare, where, you know, madness is very much a factor in these works. But finally, it was seeing how much John liked his own work, the late work, whereas he had no interest in the early work. In one of these interviews, he said to me, "They're old faces I don't care to see again." And in another interview, he said, "Poetry is no longer on my calendar." But these late writings, he got enormous pleasure and enjoyment out of writing them, out of reading them, out of reading them live. So I just went with them. And also, I was aware of the whole sort of Deleuze-Guattari idea of the schizanalysis of society. And now, today, it's those are the poems that young people really dig. You know, those are the ones that really turn people on now. Time has really caught up with John. And all of the issues that he was dealing with that made him such an outsider, especially the whole, you know, queer studies side. I mean, God, where we went, I mean, we didn't go to queer studies class, right? But, you know, that's really what, there's so many aspects of his work that made him a complete outsider for when he was writing, that now have brought him front and center in terms of the literary world. And it's extremely heartening to see how many young people have come to his work and have continued on with the task of editing him, discovering new works. So after this book came out, Allen Ginsberg agreed to write this introduction, and I just kept calling and calling and calling. Of course, he was the busiest person on the planet, and he never got around to writing the introduction. So one day I said, look, I'm coming over tonight with a tape recorder, and we're going to do the introduction. And so we did this introduction in one evening, and it said, John Wiener's glory is solitary as pure poet, a man reduced to loneliness in poetry without worldly distractions, and a man become one with his poetry, a life in contrast to the fluff and ambition of Pulitzer, National Book Awardees, poetry medalists from the American Arts and Letters and Poetry Academies, harmless bureaucratic functionaries amongst themselves, until the holders of these titles deny the pure genius of poets like John Wiener's in favor of society-minded misfits who drink, flatter, fuck, and get interviewed, sucking up the attention of the young who are misled into the study of minor poetry. Till such books as this emerge from the obscurity of decades to reveal the true light of genius in the poem. And if this curse falls on myself, so be it, that John Wiener's genius may shine forth and be proclaimed by the authority of my own fame, deserved or not. And he went on. Yeah. And then the book came out, and it had like a front page review in the New York Times book review by Robert Creeley, which in those days meant a heck of a lot more than it does today. I mean, it still means something, but it really meant something. And John Martin was just over the top, and we sold a lot of copies. And so I was able to do a second volume for Black Sparrow. And I was hoping this would happen. And when I was editing the first volume, I made sure that what I left out of it held together as a separate book, in case there could be a second book. And I wanted it to be a book that was very different from the first book. So I was thinking about what was in and what was out, and already what the second book was going to be like. And the second book is it's maybe my favorite of the two, because it's called Cultural Affairs in Boston, Poetry and Prose, 1956 to 1985. And the introduction by Creeley was adapted from his review. And so I'm going to read a little bit. I'm going to read a paragraph from that. The present collection is, then, an intense respect. Okay, let's see. He's continuing off. Okay. The present collection is, then, an intense respect of this fact that the range of its materials, three decades of poetry and prose, makes manifest the complex place from which all John Wiener's work finally has come, and to which it, as he also, insistently returns. My city, Boston. He once said to an interviewer, "I am a Boston poet." And there is no one for whom that city, or any other, has proved so determining and generative an experience. The changing faces of its presence and persons become articulate here in this dear man's immaculate art. Against the casual waste of our usual lives, his has proved a cost and commitment so remarkable. He has given everything to our common world. We read together years ago at the 92nd Street Y in New York, with its great velvet curtain raised stage. John remembered hearing Auden read there and was moved that now we would. He was thrilled that one might so follow, and so we did. But now, in these times, so bitterly without human presence, risk, care, response, he becomes the consummate artist of our common voice and his battered, singular presence, our own. And then I included an interview that I did with John. It's called A Visit with John Wiener's. And it gives a description of his apartment in Boston. It says, "Our interview took place over the Christmas holiday, 1984. Mr. Wiener's apartment on Joy Street in Boston was gaily decorated for the season with styrofoam reindeer, Santa Clauses, twinkling candles, elves made from red and green felt, and a plastic nativity scene perched atop the portable TV set in a corner of the bedroom. This is the same suite of rooms the poet has occupied for 12 years, and he tells visitors that he derives great pleasure from this corner of historic Beacon Hill. His three rooms are sparsely furnished. There is a front sitting room, a back bedroom where he sleeps and writes, and a guest bedroom. There are several bookcases, but they are all empty. Old movie magazines and 1950s detective pulp collects on his bedside table next to a copy of Beyond Beauty by Arlene Dahl. On the coffee table in the front room, Mr. Wiener has placed a black folio containing all of his work from the past 2 years." And in it, I interviewed John. "Who are the early influences on your poetry?" Wiener's: "Edna St. Vincent Millay was the first. Later, it was Charles Olson." "And at the time of the Wentley poems?" "Olson, until 1973. "And who since then?" "The Virgin Mary." "There aren't many books here, but I noticed you're reading Melville. He must have been wonderful company in those wooden frame houses." "I also saw the memoirs of Blaise Starr." Wiener's: "From which I'm borrowing heavily for my own autobiography." In assembling your collected poems, you've been reluctant to reprint much of your early work. Wieners, they're old faces I don't care to see again. You've always spoken to me quite highly of Robert Creeley's work. Wieners, oh yes, I'm mad about obtuseness. I once saw a photograph of you walking in San Marco in Venice between Olson and Ezra Pound, rather exalted company, to say the least. What was Pound like? Oh, he was a mama's boy. And it goes on and on like that. Two things I want to do is I want to read a poem, which is one of my favorite poems of John, and it's called Music, and it's dedicated to Garrett Lansing, because this is definitely a bittersweet visit, I know how we all loved Garrett and dearly miss him, and John loved him. There weren't many people who John would tolerate, particularly in later years, and Garrett he was always up for, and there weren't many people like that. Music. What is poetry? An image in the mirror, reflection from a broadside pinned to the wall, penned by a friend, from where old feelings, old meanings arise, relief from pain, the diligence of work. Mysterious words upon a page in adolescence, listening to poets read. What is poetry? Breath, competence, success, or simply eros? Four sides to everything. The increase in electricity causes lights to flow. It is only light or heat, words ordered in a row. Men are gods, I'll never know, or try to know, more than the doing, the flowing, rain upon the roof that one hears and reveres, inside, away from the cold, within the house, where the heat reminds one of what it is to be like out in the cold, rushing over the field, mad. Intelligence or emotion? Language. And I guess we should move on to Rene Ricard. How are we doing on time? How much time do we have? 15 minutes? Yeah, okay.
For Amy Levin, Nyack, New York. I wanted a companion, Herman, even a lover to fill the empty mornings as I knew them on Columbus in California. But you guarded your house too well, and the old days were over. The old nights of jazzing around, you returned to the country alone with your wife and children, and I have grieved ever since by this seashore. In bed it was worse, days I thought it over, but nights you came back harder than whispering under these sheets. I saw my hands getting older and poison smoke playing over the air. It's only memory of youth I yearn for, what I knew as a boy. The true romance of being loved, waiting for death that never came except when one kissed goodbye, pressed down by memory. I recollect hours of youth burning brightly in the evening air. How did it go? Where, except now I wind up at the plaza with no dreams at all. Pressed flowers fall out of a book, blue and yellow bound together. It's better than a hotel lobby or a lonely tea room buffeted out of winter snows. It is the last day of the week, and hard-working shop girls give thanks the weekend is here. But I have nowhere to go, no one to see, only the old lantern on the path to herald someone who never comes back, who has never come here. Solitary Pleasure, page 217.
That was Ellen Gilman. What is the name of the poem, John? He said Solitary Pleasure, page 217. John was an incredible reader of his work. I mean, he really recreated it, and every reading was completely different. You know, I remember one reading where in Pittsburgh at the Warhol Museum, where Clemente had a retrospective, he asked John to read at intermission to read a group of specific poems. And he said to me, "Will you ask John to read these? These are my favorite poems." And I asked John, and John said he would. And John was sitting on stage, and Clemente was sitting in the front row, and John pushed the microphone away, and he leaned over, and he read the poems in a very quiet voice so that only Francesco could hear them. Then there were other readings where he would sit there with a book, and he'd simply do a cut-up, where he'd be flipping backwards and forwards very quickly. There were readings where he just read from tourist brochures and movie magazines. There were readings where he didn't read at all. You know, there were times where he got to New York and somebody would sort of capture him and get him high. And one time, he was staying at the apartment where I was living, and we smoked some pot the night before. We smoked a joint the night before, and he saw where I kept the pot. And I went off to work the next day, and when I came back, he had smoked the entire bag. And he was in bed. And there was a reading at St. Mark's. And I'm like, John, you have to go to a reading. And he's like, Ray, I'm really looped. And he didn't make the reading. And then another reading at St. Mark's. St. Mark's, we used to call it poetry time. It always began at 8:45, you know, it was 40, 45 minutes before the reading began. Well, John had a reading, and he showed up at 8, and he began at 8, and he ended at 8:10. There were 6 people in the audience. By 8:30, there were 300, but he was not reading again. One time in Lowell, where Willie played, John got up on stage, and he had a picnic basket with him, and he rummaged through it quite a bit, and he took out the Black Sparrow book, and he started reading the book, but he was reading it to himself. And he'd turn the page, and he'd read the next poem. And for 10 minutes, we're watching him. And it's a poetry reading, yes. But he's not reading out loud. He's just reading the poems. I mean, it was really incredible. It was really... That's the thing about John, is like to know him in person. I mean, he was just more fun than a barrel of monkeys. And he was so witty, and you never knew what was coming, you know, next. I always like use this horrible mixed metaphor where I say he came as far out of left field and hit the nail on the head. You know, he had such precision, but he came at it from such an utterly weird place. So that kind of all prepared me for René Ricard, who is... I'm putting together a selected poems, eventually a collected, of his work. And René was another Boston poet who, let's see, how to even begin to describe René. You know, I think I might read something that I wrote about René, because I feel like I'm rambling on a bit, and this might, maybe I can be a little more concise, at least at the start. With René on this. Growing up in Lowell, Mass., I often took the train to Boston to visit Gordon Carney's Grolier Bookshop in Harvard Square, hoping to encounter an authentic poet. Harvard and Inman Squares in Cambridge had a handful of cafe, storefront galleries, and publishing collectives. The scene was dominated by the gothic shadow of John Wiener's, already possessed by drugs and madness. In a rare reading on Mother's Day, 1973, I witnessed a stunning performance by Wiener's, who read every poem he'd ever written to his mother, about 15 in all. It was over in 5 minutes, but remains as vivid as anything in my life. 30 years later, on the day John Wiener's died, René Ricard left a wet gray canvas at my door on the Chelsea Hotel that read, in a desperate scrawl, "John Wiener's, my mother, is dead. Oh, my God." Even from an early age, René Ricard was famous in the Boston poetry community for his wild beauty, fierce intelligence, and fearsome wit. He dropped out of school after completing eighth grade because he knew more than his teachers, constantly correcting even his French teacher in class. Soon he embarked on an independent study program that largely involved seducing Harvard boys. When I visited Provincetown for the first time in the early 70s, René was also famous there. Even when there were only 15 or 20 people who knew who he was famous. It was an aura that surrounded him from the start. Born at the marvelously antiquated name Boston Lying In Hospital, later Brigham and Women's, René would always bristle when his birthplace was listed as New Bedford. In his day, that was a considerable step down, despite the fact that in the 19th century, New Bedford claimed the highest number of millionaires per capita in the U.S. René grew up in Acushnet, which was also the name of the ship on which Herman Melville went to sea before writing Moby Dick. He had an abiding love of Melville, and in his younger photos, I always see René as Billy Budd, the sensitive youth fighting to survive in a claustrophobic environment full of Catholic torment, gratuitous violence, and sublimated homosexuality. René told me the defining moment of his life, was seeing a Warhol flower painting at the Boston ICA in 1966. I sat in front of that painting for 2 hours and plotted out my entire life. When Warhol came to Boston with the Velvet Underground for the opening, he shot several reels of the Chelsea girls at the Cambridge apartment of Ed Hood, who was a close friend of Renee's. Renee appears in the film, sitting silently on the bed, peeling and eating a grapefruit slowly enough to fill the entire 20-minute reel. I can say without irony that the performance is riveting. Unlike most poets who are happy to give readings and attend each other's, René hated to do either, and so his appearances were rare. When he did read, he usually arrived at the last minute, extremely high, and left immediately after. He let it be known that for him, poetry readings were poor and déclassé. Anything less than a fancy cocktail party on the Upper East Side was well below his dignity. There were, however, a few memorable readings, such as the one that... Okay, I'm going to skip this. Finally, I met René at Allen Ginsberg's apartment during one of my first visits to New York in 1978. I was 21, he was 31. I gave him my address, and the next day he woke me up, banging on my basement window that faced the street. He had a plan. He'd agreed to write an essay for Pace Gallery on Bryce Marden and wanted to collect the $10,000 in advance. We went up to West 57th Street and waited for the gallery to open. A check was written with a letter to the bank manager, and a few minutes later, René had $10,000 in cash. We immediately went to the Russian Tea Room for blinis, caviar, and vodka. The bill was $900. From there, we visited the Charivari boutique, where he bought $900 worth of Jean-Paul Gaultier underwear. The day went on like this, in this manner, and early the next morning, I dropped him at the men's homeless shelter on the Bowery, penniless. I realized I had met one of those extraordinary figures I'd always read about, Villon, Poe, Nerval, the classic poet maudit who lived by a crazy economy that involved throwing something away as soon as one possessed it. And yet throughout the day, he repaid loans, treated his poorer friends lavishly, and in general, lived like the ruined aristocrat he was, an esoteric French count fallen on hard times. It is difficult to describe the fierceness of this man from this distance. Despite that picaresque first day, it took me about 4 years to win him over. Contempt, disdain, and mistrust were standard with him. As I got to know him better, he told me about the beatings and sexual abuse he'd grown up with since the age of 8. His defensiveness became more understandable. The animal instinct to strike out was always just below the surface and did not take much to scratch. It was only after I'd edited 2 volumes of John Wiener's work and told René that I held his work in the same esteem that he began to warm to me a little. Let's see. So many years and so few poems was what Warhol said to him in his fave but acerbic way at the book party for René's first book. But René was not the prolific type. His poems were condensed, intense, and few. Some were lost due to his disarranged life, but he also had the good sense to always leave copies with mostly responsible friends. And when he hit on the idea of making poems / paintings, the writings had a much higher survival rate. But it was really Art Forum articles in the early 1980s on Schnabel, Herring, and Basquiat that put René on center stage. René was now teacher and mentor, and he loved the role of it because it meant his vast body of art historical knowledge could be channeled into contemporary works. It made him feel useful, which is pretty much all anybody wants in life. No artist made better use of what René had to offer than Jean-Michel Basquiat. René saw his work on the street and at the home of friends and sought him out. His remarkable work of agitprop on Julian Schnabel had appeared in Art Forum. At their first meeting, Jean said, "Can you put me in the ring with Schnabel?" "I'll lace up your gloves," René replied. All right, I'm going to skip to the end of this. And in the mid-1990s, René had secured an apartment in the Chelsea Hotel, and things slowly normalized to the extent that that word can be applied to him. One day I was passing through the lobby. I heard him in discussion with Stanley Bard, the hotel manager. Stanley was pointing out that René was 8 months overdue on the rent. And René was explaining that he only paid the rent once a year because it was easier for him to raise $12,000 once a year than $1,000 every month. It made sense to me, but wasn't going over very well with the manager. His small room was number 921, bed, sink, dresser, bookshelf, closet, a small space by the window to paint by the northern light. The bathroom was in the hall outside. One day he wanted to attend a Robert Creeley reading and asked me to pick him up on the way. At 7 p.m. I knocked several times and then pushed the door open. Books, papers, and garbage were piled 3 feet high. Burnt-out candles were propped on books, on the wooden tabletops, on the windowsill. Rene was sprawled out asleep on the bed in a magnificent three-piece Italian suit given him by Gregora von Rizzori's widow. We barely managed to get to the reading on time, and Creeley read his marvelous poem for Rene Ricard in tribute. The next day Robert told me how pleased he was that Rene had taken the trouble to wear a beautiful suit to his reading. I didn't have the heart to tell Robert he woke up that way. So Rene is somebody who is basically writing in a dialect of John Wiener's. John Wiener's was his mentor, and he was somebody who had a similarly disheveled life and somebody who I followed around New York, picking up the little breadcrumbs that he left behind and visiting people, gathering things. Last summer, I spent a bunch of days at the Beinecke going through Gerard Malanga's archives, and Gerard saved about 150 pages of early poems. I never thought I would find a treasure trove like that. We've brought his first book back into print with a new introduction. Afterward, Gerard was involved. A lot of people don't know that after Gerard left the factory, he went to work for Dia Foundation to run their publications program. And Rene Ricard was the first book he did. The second book was to be a John Wiener's book. But Rene behaved so horribly that the DeMille family just cut the program off. I think Rene spent the entire budget, actually. So that book never happened. He died at age 67 about 5 or 6 years ago. And I went into his room after he died and collected all the materials and brought it up to my barn in Woodstock. And now I'm sorting through there. I have a lot of notebooks. I mean, people only knew him from a few slim books, but he wrote a lot. And so right now I'm working on selected poems and hopefully a museum show, which will have his paintings, his drawings, photographs of him, manuscripts, paintings about him. You know, I'm trying to put that together for hopefully the ICA in Boston, maybe for the new museum in New York. It doesn't have to be a large show. It could just be one room and then have a catalog. But he's somebody who is very, it's like a diamond, and you have to see all the facets of what he does for it to make sense. But it's only after somebody dies, and this is the sad thing, that the whole thing snaps into focus. You know, it's like you're a carpenter working on a book, on a box, and like in the last moment, the lid closes and it like clicks and it's just right. And then you see the whole shape of the life. And it doesn't matter if the life is like 20 or 30 years or 70 or 80 years. It's a life. And at that point, time is irrelevant. You just have this shape. And the shape is the work that they did. But then the job of the editor is to mediate that work in some way that makes it accessible to people and hopefully keeps the vitality of that person, the life force, alive in some form. So I guess that's where I will end, unless you have any questions.
Hey Raymond, did they ever read together?
Thank you. Jim asked if they read together. Yes, they read together at St. Mark's at a reading for Hahnemann Books that had 14 readers on the bill. Allen Ginsberg, Gregory Corso, Herbert Hunke, John Wiener's, Cookie Mueller, Eileen Miles, Vincent Katz, John Wiener's, David Trinidad, Bob Flanagan, I'm leaving somebody important out, but yeah, that was pretty good reading. Yeah.
The video, right?
There is a video of that. Yeah. 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 But they were very good friends, and yeah, we had some pretty uproarious times in New York together.
Did Rene ever go up to John's apartment in Joy Street in the later days? You know?
No. Rene never visited John in the apartment. No.
Raymond, will you do a book of Rene's art writing?
Yeah, Yeah, yeah. Now, whether that...
Uncollected pieces of it.
I don't know how much uncollected there is, but, well, yes, I mean, once published, but not collected since. There's a fair amount, and I have a 50,000-word manuscript on Jean-Michel Basquiat by René, which was too controversial to be published. The estate would not allow it to be published in a Gagosian catalog, so we had to super clean it up, and all the good stuff is left out, and one day you'll be able to read that, because that's a book that really tells what the New York art world was like, what it's really like, you know, the intrigue and the jealousy and the... I remember one night, the night that Jean died, we just got in the news and we're like walking in Soho totally like, you know, bereft. And this incredible artist, Rammel Z, who not many people know about, but Red Bull in New York just did this amazing show, Carla McCormick. Did this amazing show of his work. And I would say, you know, aside from Jean, he was the most significant African-American artist on the scene in the 80s. He was an early, early purveyor of hip-hop and a big influence on Jean, and somebody who combined music and poetry. He invented his own language. He was a deep, deep theorist. And he created these elaborate costumes that he would wear on the street, like a kind of Sun Ra spaceman, you know. I mean, he's just truly amazing. He's dead now. He's long dead. And the night Jean died, I'm with René, and we're walking down the street, and Ram's coming the other way, and René says, "Ram, have you heard the news?" And he says, "No." And he says, "Jean-Michel is dead." And Ram says, "Now I'm the nigga." Like, whoa, indeed. I mean, and this is the art world, you know? It's like, it doesn't take long. Like, you just, you know, and he has stories like that about all the artists. It's absolutely amazing. So someday when I don't need anybody anymore in the art world, you know, this will come out. But that was René, you know. René was just about, well, as John Wiener says in one of these interviews, I say, "Do you have a theory of poetry?" He says, "I try to write the most." And I said, "Can we discuss poetry?" He says, "I'm just the co-pilot." And I say, "Do you have a theory of poetry?" And he says, "I try to write the most embarrassing thing I can think of." And that's René. You carry it, the confessional mode, to the utmost. Yeah, yeah.
Do you have your own press?
No, I had a press, you know, which was these little books that I printed in India, and John Wiener's was the first one, A Superficial Estimation. It's a text where he discusses every female member of his family in terms of a movie star. And I reprinted pictures of the movie stars with the book. When I was in India with Clemente, I put together a collection of these little books, which were sayings of saints and gurus. And we liked the format so much, we decided to start a small press. So we did 50 of these, Francesco and I, over 10 years. And John, there was no question John had to be the first. And Clemente was as crazy about John Wiener's work as I was, and felt that John really encapsulated all the themes that he was writing about in his work.
Is that Ida Lupino?
Yeah. Well, no, this is the young Elizabeth Taylor. Ida Lupino is indeed in here. And he says, "Elizabeth Taylor is my sister. You might as well know it. And as you might know, she is always with me, even though married to someone else. I recently visited them at their house on Cape Cod, where they have a small house, piquant in its quaintness against the woods of Duxbury, Massachusetts. It is large and spacious, true and blue under the oppressive clouds of August."
Yeah.
It was called Hahnemann Books. So, but I am starting another press now because I have a bunch of things that I want to publish. And so I don't have a name for it yet, but I am going to start.
You don't want to use Hahnemann. What did you say?
I don't want to use Hahnemann again, because that was that. Hahnemann was a monkey, Hindu monkey god. And, you know, that was very specific to, I mean, these were done, I was living in Madras in Chennai in India, and it was a very special spot. I mean, there was the Kalakshetra colony, which was the colony of music and dance, where Rukmini Devi had sort of resuscitated the whole lost art of Bharatanatyam, which the British forbid, and then she rebuilt the whole thing. And next to that was the Theosophical Society, and it's where Jean Renoir filmed The River, and next to that was Krishnamurti's foundation, and next to that was Krishnamacharya's yoga school. I mean, this was just all on one street. Krishnamacharya, if you get BKS Iyengar's Light on Yoga, which I think is the best book on yoga, it's dedicated to Krishnamacharya. There's a picture of him on the first page, and he's like one of the great, great gurus. And this was just like, you know, one street in Madras. So that was a particular press in a particular place and time that I don't want to, you know, I don't want to carry that name over again and choose something else. I don't know.
Did you ever get a glimmer or a gleaning of his feelings for Olson and Panagrady and his daughter? I thought that poem you read, talking about a person who never visits, was sort of moving.
Yeah, you're talking about John.
Yeah.
He never had anything but devotion for Big Charles, as he called him.
Yeah.
Never had anything but admiration and devotion. John didn't hold anything against anybody, and that's one thing I really learned from him. You know, if you don't have anything against anybody, the world is your oyster, to use that, you know, cliche. It's really true, you know? John was completely unencumbered by the past and negative feelings and jealousy, and he was so above that.
So he never reacted to Duncan's negative criticism either?
No, he thought Duncan was a bore, you know, and he didn't really care to, you know, when we went to San Francisco together a couple of times for him to do readings, and it was funny, you know, who did he want to see, who didn't he want to see, everybody wanted to see him, but, you know, he wanted to see Irving Rosenthal, and he loved Bob Kaufman, and the feelings were mutual, and Kirby Doyle he liked, he loved Deanne De Prima. John mostly liked the company of women. He did not really like being around men very much. He didn't like that aggressive male energy and all of he was really comfortable around women mostly. You know, he loved Joanne Kiger and Renee, I found a letter that Renee wrote to Charles Olson in one of Olson's in an archive, and he was probably 15, 16, and it was a letter from a young poet to an older mentor. And I don't think he ever met Olson. I don't think Olson wrote him back.
Right.
It was right at the end of Olson's life, about 1970. He did make this appeal
to Olson.
So you
Olson. Have that letter? Or
it's in a library. It's available.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Olson papers are in Connecticut.
Yeah. Well, there's a few. I'm not sure if it's at stores or if it's at. There's a couple of places where things are. Okay. You know, smaller things. But later on, Renee didn't really like many poets aside from John. Mm-hmm. He liked Gregory Corso's work very much. In fact, I didn't really get into it, but this book of Renee's that I edited for Hahnemann Books. It's the one book which is in a large size, because he made me do a large book. Well, he just didn't want the lines of his poems getting chopped up all over the place. This is a book this is the 1980s I spent collecting this material. Not everything I had would he allow me to publish, but laying this book out in my house when the day came to do it, because I was going to India a week later, I said, Renee, you know, we have to do this. This has to happen now. And Renee was, I mean, the fact that he didn't OD, or that he didn't get killed by a drug dealer, or the fact that I didn't kill him, you know, it was just amazing that he could be alive and walking around. And I said, we have to do this. So he came over to my house, and he arrived with a hustler from 42nd Street, this gangster hustler from 42nd Street, and they were smoking crack, and they were going in my bathroom, and they were having sex in the bathroom, and I'm trying to get the book laid out, you know? And this stuff is, like, going on. And I mean, you know, these really are, like, war stories, you know? This stuff is not, like, some high-minded, you know, pursuit. So, and Gregory came over. And Gregory's like, what are you doing? What are you smoking? We're smoking crack. Oh, I've never done that before. He's like, well, here, have some. And Gregory's like, well, but I hear if you do that, you get addicted for the rest of your life. And Renee, so what? So you just smoke it every day. Like one time Renee asked me if I'd ever done a particular drug, and I said once, and like it was so inconceivable to him that somebody could do a drug once. He thought I meant once as in 1 year. Like in all seriousness, you know? He's like, you mean 1 year you did that? I'm like, but let me just give you like one poem out of this, which is just so beautiful. And so if I should kill myself tonight and snuff out a lifetime of learning and a vast repositorium of lore without a biographical text to explain these scattered notes, would you publish my letters and reveal the angle that you had on me? So, if I kill myself tonight, stop the headache and the genius all at once, then you could show my letters to the world, show I loved you once, and your new lover, when he's forgot your name, can say, I knew René Ricard, and asked him once to leave my house. René's a master. Yeah, René. Okay.
Wonderful.
Okay, well, thank you very much.